Documentary Podcast. Today is Monday, February 24th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 91. My name is Rob, and with me, as always, is Mr. Madam Jason Slingerland.
Madam?
Mr. Madam. I don't know.
I don't even understand that.
I was just feeling excited all of a sudden. I don't know why.
I'm not sure why. These last 15 minutes of us just rambling back and forth wasn't very exciting.
Trying to come up with something to talk about. Hey, but I'm excited because we finally came up with something to talk about.
Let's talk about stuff.
I'm tired now.
Hey, by the way, if you're counting, it's still winter in Michigan.
Yeah. It's still freaking winter. Hey, tell me about it. Tell me about how it's winter.
It's winter.
I'm going to tell you about how it's winter. I'm going to tell you a sad, sad story about ice dams. Some of our listeners who live in warmer climates may not really understand what an ice dam is. And no, it's not just like a bunch of ice that's built up in a creek or a river.
Well, that does happen too.
It does, yeah. But I'm talking about the kind that occur on your roof. You see, if your roof is poorly insulated or poorly ventilated...
Poorly designed.
Yeah. Your roof can get hot, right? Can get at least warmer than the air around it. And so the snow that falls on your roof will melt. And then naturally, some melted snow is water. And that runs down your roof as... That's what a roof is supposed to do. It's supposed to make water run off of it. The problem is it gets to the edge of your roof where it's just the overhang. There's no insulation underneath it. And then it's cold again, and so it freezes. And so you get these big buildups of ice along the edge of your roof. Some people, again, if they have an old house like mine that's poorly insulated. And then more water runs down, but the ice is built up so high that the water doesn't run off. It just pools behind this ice dam. And then the water seeps back upward, up underneath the shingles, and into your house.
Yeah.
Which is what has happened to me this winter.
Sounds like a good time.
It's not.
For you to have.
My right arm is really sore. And the reason is that for the past 3 days, I've been up on a ladder hammering at the ice with the claw side of a hammer, trying to chip it away to get the water that's dammed up, or the water that's stagnant sitting behind the ice dam, to get it a channel to flow out and escape.
Have you thought about getting some action melt ice melting?
I went to Lowe's and I went to Menards, which is another big hardware store, retailer, home store around here, and I went to Office Depot. Home Depot.
Office Depot. Nice.
Yeah.
Wrong place.
The thing is that it's mid to late February now. So as far as the big home stores are concerned, spring is coming. So they've stopped stocking all their ice melt crap.
Oh.
And now they want to sell me patio furniture. So I had to go onto Amazon and order a bucket of specially made roof melt ice tablets.
But I guess you haven't got that yet?
No, because it's Amazon. You know,
should be on Amazon Prime, dude.
Well, I don't remind me.
I order stuff from Amazon literally almost every day now. I'm like, I could go to Walmart to, never mind, I'm going to buy it off Amazon.
Yeah, and it'll be
get
here tomorrow.
Shipped for free.
Yeah.
2 days. It takes two days.
So that's, I don't know when that's going to show. It'll probably be Thursday or Friday this week. But I'm just, I don't know. It just drives me crazy. And my arm is sore now. Like I was typing on my, I took yesterday off work. Because I needed to spend all day on a ladder hacking at ice so that my home would not be destroyed by water flowing through it. And trying to type on my computer today, my whole forearm is like twitching and shaking because so there you go.
That's fun, man. I'm excited about your ice dams.
No, you're not.
Nope, not really.
No.
I feel bad for you, though.
It sucks, dude. Yeah. It sucks real bad. But on the plus side... my buddy Larry and I went to Bell's Brewery the other day, and we got a brewery tour, and that was cool. I've never done that before.
That's cool.
I've had a couple wine tours of local wineries, but I never did a brewery tour. It's not like a winery tour. You know, you walk around a building and you see big stainless steel tanks, and right. Then people talk to you about how the alcoholic substance is made.
Within said tanks.
Within said tanks, right. And then you make the mash, and then you make the wort, and then you add the yeast, and here's what yeast is, and this is what malt tastes like. And it was neat, though. It's free, so no complaints.
Nice.
And before
free samples of beer?
No, not on the tour.
It's really probably because the tour is free.
Right, exactly.
Otherwise, people would be coming every week, and I'll get the tour.
See, then again, but every wine tour, I've been on, I think, 3 or 4 winery tours, and they always give you free booze. But come to think of it, well, I think 2 of the 4 I had to pay for, but on all 4 of them, I got free wine. So, I enjoyed that stuff, though.
Sweet.
Yeah. Good, I like.
Good story, man.
Seeing that. This is sweet.
So the moral of the story is Bell's Brewery is they make good beer.
Sweet. Mm-hmm.
You know, their Two Hearted was named the best IPA in the world by ratebeer.com just recently.
Cool. Yeah. I can't stand it.
Well,
mostly because I don't like IPAs.
Yeah, well, it's your loss, pal.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's okay.
How are you?
Oh,
I've been complaining now for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, half the show was just Rob. Blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, what have I been up to? Recently I got to play Hanabi again, I played at Unpub, and then I ordered off Amazon, had it in 2 days, free shipping.
Thanks.
Building the Game Podcast brought to you by Amazon Plus.
Yeah, Prime.
It's not. Prime, shut up. Whatever, doesn't matter. It's not brought to you by that.
No.
If it was, we'd have cooler stuff.
We'd have better equipment.
Yeah. So I got to play Hanabi with some new friends, and you know, it's interesting because the game is super easy to explain. But trying to teach people the nuance is really tough.
Yeah.
You know, like, and sometimes you're like, why don't they get it? Why don't they get it? Like, I told you this is a yellow card. That means you should play it. Like, like, you don't know what to do. You only know one thing about your hand. And I said, this is a yellow card. This is a yellow card. And they look at the board and they're like, what should I do? And like I told, I finally was like, okay, guys, time out here. If somebody tells you what one card is, that means play it. Like, that generally means play it or don't play it. Like, if I say it's a five and there are no five spots out there to play.
Hey guys. All right. If someone tells you what a card is, here's the thing. You either play it or you don't play it. Okay. That's so clear, Jason.
Circumstantially, you should know what we're talking about. You wouldn't understand if you never played the game.
No, I haven't. But I mean, that's... Anyway, all right, go on.
Anyway, so like we figured it out. It was, you know, we did pretty well. I think we stopped short because we didn't realize that after the cards ran out that everybody got to take another turn. We'd have got 20 points if we had, which was pretty awesome. We got 18. I was pretty happy with that. It's a good score. The score I've gotten in every game of Hanabi that I've played, actually, which is only two. But but it's fun, you know, and now they're interested in trying it again because of that.
Now they get it better.
Yeah, man, okay. I was talking today to somebody, and now I really want to play Chip again. And it stinks because it's not really your game. You're not a big fan of it.
It just didn't click for me.
I really want to play it again, though. I want to find some people to play Smash Up with, some better people than you.
Why are you jonesing for it again?
Because I was talking to somebody about it today.
Oh, just talking about it.
I was like, I want to play Smash Up!
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know, I had a similar feeling, because with all this garbage with my roof, we're calling in, and we... trying to see if we're going to do an insurance claim, maybe get a new roof out of the deal. So with the adjuster coming over, that means they're going to be walking all over their house and looking at stuff. And so my wife and I started to clean up, and I was cleaning up our game cabinet, and I found this old pack of Pirates of the Spanish Main. Do you remember that? Did you ever play that?
I didn't play it, but I've heard of it. Is that the one with the ships you build?
Yeah, the little plastic cards that you pop the ship pieces out. And I'd forgotten that I even had these. It's an old WizKids game, and I'm sure it's not in print anymore. But this was out kind of before I even really got into gaming hardcore. And I remember just being at the store and seeing that and being like, oh man, that is the coolest thing. That is so smart. And so I just bought a huge pile of booster packs, and I have a ton of ships, and I think I've maybe played the game two or three times.
You haven't even put these together.
Well, that you pop them out of the plastic and then put them back in to keep them safe.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really smart.
Yeah, but that sounds like a pain.
It's totally easy. It's totally easy. It's not difficult at all.
How many ships in a game?
I think you can play with one per player up to like three per player. It's very, very scalable, and it's 2 to 4, maybe 2 to 6 players. Like I said, it's been a long time since I played it. But I remember really liking a lot, but I didn't have any friends that were into like minis and strategy combat games and stuff like that. So I never really had a chance to play it too much. So I'd really like to try it again.
Yeah.
Because I remember the mechanics being real simple and
we should try
pretty
it sometime.
Smart.
It looks like fun.
Maybe on lunch sometime at work.
Yeah, I would totally try it.
Because I remember having a ton of fun with it. So I've just got this Ziploc bag that's been sitting in my game cabinet for years now, untouched. Just something I want to get back to. So if anybody else out there, oh, that was loud.
That was really loud.
If anybody else out there has played Pirates of Spanish Main and has thoughts on that, email us and let me know what you think about it, because I'm interested to hear what other people think. I don't know that it lasted terribly long. Like I know you could buy it in booster packs, and I think there was like a big box set that you could buy also. And I remember the first year we went to Gen Con on clearance for like $25.
You should have bought that.
Well, I should have, but it was one of those things where I'd already spent too much money, you know?
Right.
So
every Gen Con I know.
Pretty much every Gen Con. By day two, I've spent too much money. Yeah, anyway, so I haven't really been playing anything lately because we've been working on house crap. And
right.
I've been working a water balloon washout. Do you want to mention the status of that?
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So we got the proof back.
And it looked great.
I'm really, really happy with
it. I couldn't believe it.
So
it looked really good.
And I got some backers that let me know that they really thought it looked cool. We had a couple things we wanted to change. One card just was a little dark. It was actually kind of funny. It looked like the water balloon, the shadow, looked like it, like somebody had set it on fire.
Right, it looked burnt.
So, yeah.
Which so had to lighten
really
that up a bit.
Work for a water balloon. So, yeah, Rob lightened that up a little bit, and we're going to do another proof just for the heck of it. And here, I'm going to say this. I feel like a jerk saying this, but we're going to do another proof because I don't trust the company that's printing it to not do another proof.
Yeah.
I want to see if this was like another company and they had given me good vibes, I would just trust. We're replacing one card. It's in three places in the print. I distinctly told them which three spots that was.
Mm-hmm.
Communicated very simply. But I'm terrified they're going to mess it up. So
yeah.
So I'm paying extra money to do an extra proof because I don't trust them, which is kind of frustrating.
And it's slowing everything down by at least a week, if not two.
Right. But I don't want to not do it and then have like something crazy get jacked up, like one of the backs not match.
Right.
I mean, when that first proof came in and everything on their side was perfect, it was just something printed a little darker than we thought on one card.
Made us real nervous.
Yeah, we were like, how is this possible? Yeah. They did a good job. Right. Like,
because we hear about all kinds of delays from other people. I mean, we won't name names, but somebody else that we know who actually had their game done through them recently had just tons of problems. So,
and a lot of ongoing issues with them too.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Right.
And I mean, to be fair, it looks great. Like,
it really does look good.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah.
It's just sad that we were surprised that was the case. Not that we didn't think it was going to look good. We just thought that it was going to be messed up. Like
we thought
card backs wouldn't line up
right.
You know, they'd be on the wrong card. Because in this, there's 16 cards that have special backs, which are the kids. Because it's the kid on one side and then the wet version of the kid on the other side. And then the rest of them are just standard back.
Right.
With the cards. And I was really nervous about those being messed up. And were they getting the card counts wrong? But all the card counts line up to what
right
I expected.
Yeah.
You know, and you worked really hard to make that doubly clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Maybe this is not what we wanted to focus on with this episode, but maybe I should talk a little bit about doing the graphic design for that.
Yeah. What
just on the experience, but just because it's probably kind of pertinent to the subject, huh? You know, come to think of it, why don't we just make that our feature of the week this week?
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Cool. We'll just push the idea we had for the other one off till next week.
Yeah.
So
okay.
That's great.
All right. So, I'm still largely an amateur graphic designer. I mean, I think that I'm probably on the high end of amateur, if I'm being honest, but
I would say at least on the high end of amateur. But I think you're better than that, but
well, but only because I don't really get many gigs, you know. So I hesitate to call myself a pro, but at any rate, I think I have a pretty decent eye for it. But I'm just self-taught with Photoshop, you know. I've just been essentially playing with Photoshop for 25 years. Well, not 25 years, 20 years. So I never took the time to learn any other software. So when this expectation came up, I realized, oh, holy crap, I'm going to need to learn how to use Illustrator and how to use Adobe InDesign. And I was surprised how easy both of those pieces of software were to learn.
Well, Photoshop is probably the most complex of the three,
I
right?
I think it might be. And maybe not. Maybe they're all equally complex. But I think what I learned from this is that if you already have an understanding of how one piece of Adobe software works, then you're going to be able to translate a lot of what you know into the other pieces of software, which is, I think, speaks highly of Adobe's design and interface processes.
That makes sense, you know? Yeah.
So I've been very pleased with how easily some of the stuff that I've learned translates between each piece of software. the number one thing that we got from their graphic people at the printer, they said everything has to be vector art. Everything has to be done in Illustrator. Period. You know, end of discussion. Absolutely no argument on that. Because if you don't use vector art for everything, your cards are going to look fuzzy and they're going to look terrible. And they're not wrong about that.
Right.
Because vector art is the best way to guarantee that you're going to get a crisp image in the end.
Especially scalability-wise, right?
Exactly right. Now, all that said, though, I had already done all of the work, literally all of the work right. in Photoshop. I was done. I had finished all of the cards in Photoshop.
And this, we talked a little about this. This is where they kind of dropped the bomb and it said, oh, by the way, you have to do it this way, even though we've been asking these questions for a long time. And they finally told us that. When
after the work was already done.
When we were saying, how do we submit this now? And they were like, oh, we need this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was really frustrating.
That put us about a month back.
It sure did, yeah.
Because it took time for you to fix that. And it was the holidays. You purposely got it done before the holidays, and then we had the holidays.
And we had the holidays and slowed everything down. Right. So when I had time to get back to that, and this is basically took me a significant portion of January to do that, I had to make a decision that, as to whether I was going to start over 100%, or if I was going to kind of just copy and paste from Photoshop into Illustrator and hope for the best, or you know, what ratio of original work to new work was I going to do? So, in trying to make that decision about how much to redo and how much to preserve from the original, I took a look back at the original artwork that we had gotten from Brendan, and of course, Brendan. He did not do vector art, you know, it was all hand-drawn stuff, hand-colored. And so that was not vector-based, that was just art, you know, it was a graphic.
Now, granted, he drew it big.
He did,
so that, because knowing that it's just going to be printed on little cards.
Right.
Now, if we wanted to make a huge poster of it,
that'd be a different story. It'd be a different story, right. But, so I was looking at that and I was thinking, well, I mean, obviously this is not going to be, this is never going to be vector, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. And in most art that you're going to see in games like that is not originally a piece of vector artwork.
Exactly.
So,
in fact, a lot of the artists we've met, we've only met one that specifically only works in vector, and that was
Jake Ruth.
Yeah. And that's all he does. But everything in his is very smooth. And I mean, like, vector wise, it's like the perfect thing to do in vector art.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it worked really well for him. But most of the artists that we know don't do that.
Right.
So I was thinking, you know, obviously, I mean, we expect that to be crisp, right? We expect that to be a nice, clean piece of work.
Right.
Right. So what else of the design that I've already done can I preserve that I think is still going to be okay? And that that turned out to be the background of the images.
Right.
So the basic background, most of the background was going to be just a piece of Brendan's art, right?
Right.
With just some color changes in the background, you know, and a little border on it. And I figured, well, that's probably going to be okay. Why take the time to redo all that stuff, and not only redo it all, but have to do it all for, you know, what, 30 different unique cards?
Right.
Yeah. So I just kept the work that I already did on in Photoshop with that and called it good. So what I redid was I redid the icons on each card.
Okay. Because, I didn't realize that, actually.
Yeah, because those were vector originally, and they were it took me a lot less time to recreate.
I mean, they're cool looking, but they're pretty simple. I mean, they're not super complex or anything.
Right. And then I just redid all the text. Because it's really important that the text be very crisp.
And they warned us that the text was the number one thing, that if you took the text from Photoshop and put it in InDesign, a lot of times it would be fuzzy.
Yeah. The first was into
Illustrator.
Illustrator. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So. That by making that decision to only redo part of it, that cut a lot of my workload down a lot. And I was really, really nervous about whether I'd made a bad choice or not. But but in seeing the final proofs, we realized it looked great. It looked fine.
Yeah. No, there was no. I mean, it's completely crisp. Right. Everything is crisp.
And that's also, though, because we started... the originals I did in Photoshop were very high resolution.
Right.
So they scaled well. They scaled very well.
And I'm assuming you made them bigger than you needed to, probably.
I did. I usually do, because I learned the hard way several times in the past to just...
Right.
If they say do it at 300 DPI, do it at 600. And that's overkill 90% of the time.
Right.
That's way overkill.
But... it helps it scale if they need to make it
bigger. But in cases like this, I'm really glad that I did do that.
Yeah.
So then moving on to the rules document. The rules document was done in InDesign, which I had never even seen before. You know, never even looked at least Illustrator I'd looked at and played around with a little bit.
Right.
But InDesign, I was totally lost. Talk about an easy, intuitive piece of software to use.
Really?
That's yeah, good to know. I was super lucky.
I'll have to check that out, because like, yeah. I have trouble in Photoshop. Maybe I'd be better off in InDesign.
Yeah. So, and that was mostly text layout, which was easy to do. And if you're familiar with any kind of a basic desktop publishing piece of software, you'll probably do okay with InDesign as well. A lot of the stuff is similar to how Microsoft Publisher works. So it's pretty simple. The one thing, though, that they came back to me with, and I did the whole document and I submitted to them, that was okay. And there are a couple pictures in that document,
right,
that I set up as PNGs.
Right.
Okay, they were just PNG files, because I'm used to working with PNGs a lot from Photoshop.
Yeah.
And they came back and they said, well, we don't want you to use a PNG. We want you to use an Illustrator file, because the Illustrator file, I didn't know, we realized you could paste an Illustrator file into an InDesign document. So I was, hey, that's cool.
Right.
And they said that'll work better because it'll be, again, a crisper end result.
And what was funny with that is when you see the rules, if you've got the game, like, the pictures are so stinking small.
Right.
Other than the logo, the pictures are so small that, yeah, I can't imagine any file would not have been good enough just because they're so tiny. But
yeah,
I mean, we didn't want to risk it, but not being good.
And I was worried about that because I had done the original mock-ups for that stuff in Photoshop and just saved them as PNGs and sent them out there. And I did a little research about saying, gosh, do I really need to recreate all this? Because I had done a full layout of like how the game board was done.
Uh-huh.
And that was just a flat PNG. That was, if I was going to do that in Illustrator, I would have had to start over from scratch. And that just could have taken a whole day. I don't know.
Right.
And so I did some research into that. And their point was, a PNG, when it scales down, becomes pixelated.
Okay.
Even if it starts at a higher resolution, it can get fuzzy because of the file format. But if you take that PNG and you put it into an Illustrator file, and just like one-to-one, PNG into the Illustrator file and then the Illustrator file into InDesign, it actually scaled cleaner.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. So I just basically had to open up those PNGs in Illustrator and save them as an Illustrator file so that it would be a cleaner scale on the InDesign.
Cool. Well, that's good to know.
Weird how those things all interact with each other.
Yeah.
But it was a really interesting learning experience that I'm very pleased that I had.
So with the cards, what did you, you know, when it came to doing there's three main types of cards, other than the kid cards, which are their own separate thing. But
yeah,
when it comes to the action cards in the game, there's three. There's defensive cards, there's water cards, mm-hmm, and then there's utility cards.
Right.
So what you did for that, just so that everybody kind of understands, you've had three separate colors. Mm-hmm. Water cards are blue. Defensive cards are red, mm-hmm, and utility cards are green,
right,
with a border around them.
Right.
And then you made a different symbol for each one. A water, mm-hmm, card is a drop of water. A defensive card is a little shield type thing.
Right.
And then
utility is like a wrench.
Yeah, because we wanted very iconic, you know.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of what drew you to doing it that way?
Yeah, that's an important thing. A lot of people don't think about colorblindness, which, you know, and I don't know a whole lot about it. Okay, I'm not sure. When I say don't know a lot about it, I mean, I'm not sure what colors pop and what colors kind of run together.
I know I've heard a lot of times about red-green deficiency.
You hear about that, but I know there's another type as well.
Right.
So it's one thing that frustrates me a lot about video games, like puzzle games that have color puzzles.
Right.
And I see that, and I kind of feel like, you know, so you just kind of don't want some people to be able to play your game, or you don't care if a certain percentage of the population can't play your game,
right,
because they can't see the colors that you're trying to get them to match. And I think that's an important consideration to keep in mind when you're doing something like this. People who are not colorblind, they respond quickly and easily to color, you know, and that's, it's a great way to be able to separate things and help people organize things. But equally important is having easy icons, easy things for people to recognize, and different people pay attention to things in different ways, colorblind or not. So when we talked about formatting these things, we decided we wanted to make sure we had color as well as a separate icon,
yep,
to easily differentiate between the different card types. And even that is not super important in the game, but it's good to be able to organize your hand however what you want to.
Right.
You know, so to give people those kinds of things to key into is really, really important.
And plus the artwork too kind of lends itself to that in general. Like mm-hmm. water balloon cards are clearly water balloons.
Right.
I mean, they're right. a big water balloon
right.
of varied colors.
Right, right. So all that kind of stuff is important when it comes to putting together an end result that is intuitive, you know, that people are not going to be scratching their heads when they look at it, trying to figure right. out what that thing is.
And, you know, I mean, we want this to be a simple game that plays quickly.
Yeah.
And having those simple little things added in mm-hmm. makes that happen fast.
Yeah.
You know, makes that happen better and achieves that goal a little easier.
Yeah, right, right. So, yeah, hallmarks of good design for me are clarity and simplicity. You know, I really respect that a lot in things that are well designed. Make it easy for me to see the information that I need and don't put a lot of crap in my way.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. That's cool. And I'm really happy with how it's turned out, and everybody has been, you know, really happy mm-hmm. with when I've showed it to people, they've had really good response to, oh wow, this looks good. Like mm-hmm. this really looks, you know. My wife was looking at the proofs of me and reading the rules and stuff and looking at it. She said, "This is like a real game. Like a real game you would buy somewhere, except for you designed it."
Yeah.
I'm like, it's pretty crazy, isn't
it? It's crazy. Yeah. I hadn't talked at all about the box, putting the box together, but I mean, it's kind of more of the same. It just, again, put it all together in Illustrator. A lot of the core layout I had already done in Photoshop. I actually had to redo more of that than the cards.
Did you?
Yeah, but it wasn't terribly difficult. It was pretty easy. Because there wasn't a lot of custom coloration and stuff to be done. You know, it was right. more just about taking elements that I'd already put together and just laying them around on top of each other to make sure it worked. So, I'm pretty pleased with how it's looking. I was also pleased to see on the proof that the color on the proof matched pretty darn closely to the color on my computer monitor.
It did, yeah.
Which means that my computer monitor is tuned pretty well.
Yeah.
I know that they sell like devices to allow you to precisely tune the color on your screen, and I've never done that. And so I'm very pleased with my ViewSonic monitor that I got in clearance about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, no, I was impressed too, you know, just from looking at the colors you had sent me to mm-hmm. the colors that printed.
Yeah.
Great representation of that. So
yeah. So anyway,
makes you feel good considering, you know, how many times we've used like the Game Crafter and things come yeah. out so dark, you yeah. know?
Right. It's not me.
Yeah.
It's right. not me. Yeah. So that's good. Anyway, that's enough. That's probably kind of a boring subject for a lot of our listeners. So hopefully you guys suffered through that. Okay.
It was good information though. I know there's a lot of people out there that are interested in that, you know, and mm-hmm. especially, I mean, there's just people like me out there too who design but just don't know much about the graphic design portion of it, so it's cool to hear mm-hmm. someone talk about that.
Yeah. So, anyway, moving on, practicing the pitch. It's your turn tonight.
It is.
Pitch your game. Go. Now. Hurry. Faster.
Hold up my
faster,
notes.
Faster.
Sometimes I need notes, sometimes I don't. This time I'm going to go with notes.
Okay.
Okay, so the game I'm going to pitch tonight, kind of the inspiration came from recently I was I needed to sew a button back on something, and I was looking through a drawer for kind of like our sewing kit.
Looking for buttons.
Yeah, well, and I was actually looking for a sewing kit, and I found the sewing kit, and I found this bag, and I'd forgotten that I bought this, but like there was a shirt I had that had lost a button, and I was looking for one that matched. So I went to Walmart, and I just bought this big bag of buttons. And of all different kinds. And I found one that was close enough. I sewed it back on my shirt. Everybody was happy.
Big bag of buttons.
Yeah, but I have this big bag of buttons, right?
Big bag of buttons.
So I...
That's a good game name. Big yeah, bag of buttons.
It's not going to be called that. But so anyways, I saw this bag, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, I was thinking about pulling buttons out of a bag. Because they all have slightly different textures to them, slightly different sizes, different ridges and stuff. And I thought, there's something here with this that could be fun. So I was trying to think of a way to make it fun, and I think I did. Maybe not. Maybe it's terrible. I'm not sure, but we'll find out. So the name of the game, I'm calling it Tailoring Tails. Tails being T-A-I-L-S. The idea is that you run a tailor shop, and the customers are a bunch of anthropomorphic animals.
Furries.
Who are actual anthropomorphic animals, not people in suits. But these animals are actually wearing suits, like real suits, like tuxedos and button-down suits and dresses and such.
Mm-hmm.
So these customers are coming into your shop, and you're attempting to make what they want. And what they want is represented by a number of buttons, generally going to be either somewhere between 2 and 4 buttons that they need to make this. So the main thing that's happening in the game is you are drawing buttons out of a bag every turn. You get so many actions, you know, and one of those can be to draw a button out of the bag. And you kind of know what you're going for because there'll be a line of customers in your store. There'll be 5 customers at any given time. They all want different things. Now, what's going to happen is every turn, these customers are going to conveyor belt through your store, right? So the one who's been there the longest is going to go away. The newest one is going to come in, but with one catch. Now, the gorilla in front of you who needs a new tux, right? His tux needs 4 buttons, 4 very specific styles of buttons. Now, you can claim him, like start working on him. So by putting one of those buttons down on your side in front of him, right? So you set it in front of him, and now you've claimed him. You're like, hey, I gotcha. I'm going to fit you. So wait, right? So at the end of the turn, he's going to shift, but he's not going to leave. So what's always going to happen is the first available customer who hasn't been helped is going to leave. Does that make sense? So you have 5 in a row, but 3 of them now at the end are being helped. That 4th one is going to go away. The second newest one, basically.
Okay.
And eventually, the newest one will be there for one turn and go away. And if you claim them all, then the oldest one goes away again. Because he's just fed up. Because you're helping so many people, and you're not helping him. So he's going to leave, and it's all going to shift, and it begins again.
Okay.
So what'll happen is, you claim that. Now, if somebody else wants to jump on board and steal your clients, right? Because you all work in this tailor shop, and you all want to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
They just have to come in with more buttons. So if he's a 4-button suit, right? Well, let's say he's a 4-button suit. So you put down a button. Now they want to come in and claim it, right? So they've got 2 buttons for his suit. So they're going to put the 2 buttons down on their side. Well, now he's their client, right? But you helped. So you can't play anymore unless you could play. No, you wouldn't be able to play anymore because now you can't. Because you'd have to play more than they have played, right? But you can't because there's only 4 buttons allowed on his suit. You've put on 1, they've put on 2. So as long as they complete the last button, they're going to get it. So that makes you think, first of all, do I want to just push him out, right? So that nobody finishes his suit. But I thought it'd be cool if when you win, when you complete it, the winner is going to get points for that. But the second place person is going to get something too. They're going to get a little kickback. And it would be different for every customer. On some customers, it would just be straight up some points they get for it, like lesser points. But on others, it might be something that allows them to manipulate the game. For instance, maybe they can draw an extra couple buttons out. And the idea is that your buttons would kind of be in secret. You'd keep them covered. So whatever your button stash was, nobody would exactly know what you had. So they wouldn't necessarily know if they wanted to claim something ahead of you, right?
Okay.
But I think that adds a little more strategy to a simple game, have it so that you can play a button. But if you claim someone and you complete them, and completing them is kind of smash up style, as in they need 4 buttons. So once 4 buttons has been achieved, the person with the most buttons wins that order.
Okay.
But it gets completed either way. Does that make sense? So if I put down 3 buttons, you've got 1 button down and I put down the other 3. I completed the order, but it was with your help because we needed 4 buttons in total. Mm-hmm. Kind of like with Smash Up with the, you know, this base has 30 hit points and we have to deal that much damage to it. And it doesn't matter who deals it. It's a total of, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's kind of the game. I mean,
So how do you get the buttons?
You draw them out of the bag. Every turn you would draw 1 button out of the bag and put it into your stash.
And there's different kinds of buttons.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, and so you're thinking that you can, based on what you can feel from the button, you feel like maybe that one, that feels like a red one, that feels like a blue one.
And the rule would be, I think you got about 3 seconds to reach in and take your hand back out. You know, I don't want somebody, like, and I think it would say this, you need to reach in and take something out. You can't sort the buttons in the bag. Because obviously somebody could be a schmuck and do that, and that's not fun. So it's really about reaching in, kind of, got it, okay, I want this one. And then you put that in your stash, and I would have ways for you to be able to trade in buttons. Like, all right, I'm going to grab three more buttons and then put two buttons back, you know? So on your turn, you'd have some options for what you could do. I don't really have that solidified yet. But I think, you know, having options would be important so that you could, you know, do one thing or another. So it's not just like play a button, you know what I mean? Or draw a button. There would be ways to manipulate that a little bit.
Yeah. So when you're putting the buttons down, it's a four-sided card. So basically you just put the button to claim it on your side of each card.
Yep. Kind of like you do with Smash Up, where you just put it on your side so everybody remembers it's you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And so, when that gorilla gets all four of the buttons, that card just goes back in the discard and you get your cubes or whatever.
Correct. So you would then get your points, and then the second place person would get whatever they get. Like I said, whether it's points or a bonus, like it may just be like, hey, you get 2 points, or it may be you can do this, like choose another customer and remove them. So that might make you think like, oh, I don't want to help this person complete this order because I don't want to give them that ability.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so when the customers all run out, then whoever has the most points wins.
Yeah, or just play to a certain point total to make the game go a little faster.
Okay. Any reason why anthropomorphic animals?
I just think it's more fun than just having people. Like, I don't know, I kind of like the idea. Plus, I kind of like the name Tailoring Tales. So, rather than just, like, having standard people come in, I think it'd be cool, and, like, the artwork having to be, like, animals and such.
Uh-huh. I think it might be funnier if they're not anthropomorphic. If it's literally a gorilla in a tuxedo and a llama with a nice dress on or something.
You always want to do that. With Scrapper Cats, you want to do the same thing.
Yeah, I did. Because that's funny.
I think anthropomorphic is better.
Hmm.
I know about these things. I don't, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's kind of my pitch.
Okay. And so then after something is scored, the buttons go back in the bag?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would. I think they'd go back in the bag because, you know, obviously a lot of buttons would be reusable on different people, so you'd want them back in the bag.
How many different kinds of buttons?
Oh, probably maybe 10 different kinds.
Oh, that's a lot of buttons. That's a lot of different buttons.
Maybe not 10. I don't know. I was thinking 10. Maybe I want it to be a little difficult. Like, you know, like I think I would probably start with 10 different kinds of buttons. So maybe like 30 buttons-ish in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, component-wise, buttons. Buttons could be tough to get in big quantities like that, but I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I bought a bag of buttons off Amazon to make sure I have enough.
Is it like just assorted random buttons?
100 random buttons for like $6, yeah.
Yeah, see, random buttons probably wouldn't be a big deal, but if you want specific...
You would need specific ones for the game, obviously.
Right, obviously. So, I mean, it'd be easy to find just a big bag of buttons. Big bag of buttons. Is there a different way to approach it, maybe, where you could just use a random lot of buttons? Like maybe make it instead of a specific button, say a brown button or a blue button or a square button.
Might not even need to be that. It could just be a button, and when you put a button on it, you claim it.
Yeah.
Like it just says 4 buttons. So if I put a purple button on that, you now know, crap, I have to play purple buttons if I want this.
Oh yeah. So in that case, it could be like an Uno thing. You know, where you got either have to play the same color or the same size or something.
Yeah, and if you can't do that, then you have to try a different animal.
I need a button with a pattern on it. I need a button with a fabric cover.
Even to have like matching buttons, wouldn't it be hard? As long as they weren't tied to the game, like as long as it wasn't on the player the cards for the animals.
Yeah,
it wouldn't matter. You just need to have like 10 sets of 4 matching buttons.
Yeah.
So if this guy needs 3, I know that we're going to need 3 whatever color I choose of buttons or whatever color and size. So
yeah.
I think that actually would be really cool. That's a good idea. Yeah. Strategy-wise, that adds a little more too and makes the game a little simpler. You don't have to worry about running into issues with matching and stuff.
Yeah, because I'm thinking as an alternative way to approach it is that if you could have the buttons made, or if you could make the game with just, you know, chipboard tokens with buttons printed on them of different colors and shapes, but say in the rules that alternatively you could just use your own random bag of buttons that you have at home. It might be an interesting way to do that. But then you lose the feel and the texture of it, you know?
Right. Cool.
Yeah. Cool. It's the only thing that's coming to mind.
Yeah. I like.
So, there you go. That's something. Should we move on to questions and emails?
Because we have a lot
of
them.
We have a ton of them, dude.
So, let's start with Twitter questions. We'll burn through those, and then we'll switch over to emails and some other feedback we got.
Okay.
So, first Twitter question. I'm going to take this one because it's super easy to answer.
Yeah.
John Dubois asked, how would you approach a time travel theme game? Simple. I would make it a memory game with three tableau. I mean, with three grids. I would call it Scrapyard Cats.
About cats who time travel.
then I would get feedback from a publisher that it was too complex and that people were confused, and they would be right.
Yeah.
But actually, if you want to know a really cool way to approach a time travel game that's unique, listen to the episode where we talked to the guys from
Sparks Games,
because they had a really sweet idea.
Kind of inspired by the movie Looper.
Yeah, and it was great.
That was a super exciting idea, and I hope they continue to. I hope they figure that out.
Because so
this is a cool idea. We've got one here from Phil Kilcrease at Fistry Games, who we talked to not too long ago. He says, what steps do you take in assessing what feedback to accept and what feedback to reject?
Well, feedback is good, we accept it. If it's bad, we reject it.
How do you know when it's good and when it's bad, Jason?
Well, I think a lot of times you don't know right off the bat. Unless, I mean, sometimes you could... I don't know, though. Sometimes I get a feeling when somebody gives me feedback, I'm like, this is bad feedback. But then I'm wrong, and it's actually really good feedback.
Well, one of the things that I... One of the... and I think, I to some degree, I do this unconsciously, but I consider whether their feedback would change the tone or change the goals that I have with the game. And we talked about that with the Zombie Racing League, where you had given me some suggestions about different ways to handle that, and I immediately rejected that. And we agreed that afterward that I rejected that because it would have changed the tone of the message that I'm trying to get across with a game, you know? So if what the person is suggesting would change some core functions and fundamentals of your game, maybe it's not really... I'm more likely to reject it. And maybe in that case you should not consider it because
well, I know some of the worst feedback that we've gotten, like over the years, and this hasn't been recent, but a while back, I know both of us, for instance, with Maelstrom, you received some feedback from someone that was basically like, this game would be better if you made it a different game. Like, it wasn't even like, here's a way to make your game slightly better. It was like, hey, this game would be way better if it wasn't this game, if it was another game.
Yeah.
Because that's the game I'd rather play. And that wasn't bad feedback. It just was mistargeted feedback for how do I make this game better? It was make this other game instead.
Right. So So look for something that is in line with your goals for the game. And I think look for something that is genuinely trying to help you make it a better game.
Right. And never discount feedback immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, always think about it, because even feedback where somebody says, change your game to be like this, you still might be able to get something good out of that if you think about it. Like, why were they saying that? Like, what makes it, you know? Because some of the best feedback I've gotten at first kind of sounded outrageous. And then I thought about it and was like, oh, no, this is good feedback. Like, this makes my game, you know, way better.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's our thoughts on feedback. You got the next one?
How do you avoid getting disheartened from zero feedback as opposed to usable negative feedback?
Oh, that's so hard. That's hard. That's from Robin Lees.
Yeah, I would always rather get negative feedback than no feedback.
Yeah, zero feedback is kind of the worst part.
And I feel like we talk about this at Unpub a lot with some people, that when somebody gives you strong feedback about your game, like, a lot of times it's not because they think your game sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they really feel like there's something that your game could be good at, and they want to tell you what it is. But when they just say, no, all right, thanks, and they don't give feedback, it really feels like they're just saying, your game's not even worth giving feedback
to. A strong reaction, either positive or negative, is still a strong reaction to your game, and that's probably a good thing.
Exactly.
Right, but no feedback or neutral feedback means that they just didn't care to think about it that much. And that's tough. That's real tough. So how do you
power through that? Beer helps. You just got to tell yourself that this is not an easy gig. This is not an easy project that we do, and remind yourself that you're doing this because you enjoy it, not because you want fortune and glory, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened there. He just kind of like went on this like Jerry Maguire-esque speech.
Well, no. Well, that's what he was asking. You know, he was saying, how do you avoid getting disheartened? Just remind yourself why you started doing this, because you enjoy it, right?
And remember that we get disheartened sometimes too.
We absolutely do. And we've talked about that. We try to be honest about that, about our feelings about that. And it can be discouraging when things don't go the way you'd hoped them to. So you just kind of have to remind yourself that you're doing this because you enjoy it and it's a hobby, and that
exactly,
and that's, you have to be okay with that sometimes.
The question that ties in good with that is, mm-hmm. how has the hobby affected your responsibilities, family, friends, etc.? Games require a lot of time. That's from Brian Hank.
Yeah. Well, I my wife and I don't have any kids, so we have a little bit more free time than you do, I think. But, I think we're also in a weird position, because it's not only games, it's also this podcast that takes up a lot of our time.
Right.
How's it affected that? Well,
certainly, I mean, with the podcast, it's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
We have less time to design because of the podcast, but we also get a lot more ideas because of the podcast.
We have a lot more motivation because we want to make sure we're...
Right. Because we have lots and lots of you guys out there pushing us to do stuff, which is great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my wife and I probably played more games together before this podcast, before I started designing stuff.
Yeah.
Because since then, I feel like I'm always talking about it and always thinking about it, and I think she gets tired of that.
Right.
And my wife does too. When we're hanging out, just not doing anything, or those nights when we would often sit down and play a game of Carcassonne or something, now we'll watch some TV instead, because she doesn't want to listen to me talk about games for another hour.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and my wife and I, too, we play a lot less games than we used to, partly because we have a kid now, and we'll soon have two kids, and that makes that just a little more difficult. And the people we used to play regular games with, we don't get to as much anymore, and we don't get together as much as we'd like, just because it's just difficult sometimes scheduling. So, and a lot of the games we play now are prototypes, so, you know... That's tough.
Yeah. That said, though, I think I've actually done more gaming with friends since we started doing this, because I'm talking to people about it a lot more, you know, and right. it's a subject of conversation. So people remember more. My friends remember more often that I'm into this, because I'm talking about it more. And so they're more likely to say, hey, why don't you bring a game with you when you come over? So so I'm doing less gaming at home, but more gaming with friends. So it's been kind of a weird dichotomy there.
That's funny.
Yeah. Let's see. Next up, we have we have one from Pavel Predke. He says, "Have you played Last of Us on PS3? And if not, stop the podcast and do it now."
I haven't, but I've heard it's really good. Yeah. I want to play it.
I haven't either.
I've heard it's amazing.
It was on a just dozens of Game of the Year lists for 2013. I got caught up in Minecraft here and haven't gotten around to
right. And I was caught up in that for a while, and I just kind of stopped playing it.
Right.
Because I've been working on other stuff.
Plus, I'm also kind of waiting for it to be free on PlayStation Plus.
Yeah. Hey, make sure to let me know when that happens, because I might not notice.
Yeah, I figure it. All the other Naughty Dog games were free on Plus at some point, so I have to assume this will be eventually.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to wait for that.
Just don't forget to tell me, please.
We'll see.
Because I know I'll forget to download it if you don't tell me. And then the last one here we have from Danny Devine. Do you feel like you have a design crutch, meaning a component or mechanic you always use as a default? I can answer that with absolutely variable player powers.
Yeah. Like
100%. I struggle to not put that in games because I love it so much.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure. If I have a crutch, I don't know it. So maybe listeners, maybe you could if you'd give me a feeling on that.
Off the top of my head, yeah, I can't think of one you have, you know. And for me, variable player powers, it's such an easy thing to add to a game that it's hard for me not to. So to combat that, Danny didn't ask this, but to combat that, like, I do things like design a game that is completely predicated on that, like Sandbox Showdown, because it kind of gets it out of my system, right? Like, it's like, yeah, that game is 100% variable player powers. Mm-hmm. So I do that.
Yeah, I don't know. If I have a crutch that I'm not aware of, builders out there, let me know, because if I do, I need to identify that and stop using it. That's it for Twitter questions. I think we have some emails also.
We do.
I've got one from James, who we talked with before. James with Stellaris Games. He's the guy who did Schrodinger's Wager on GameCrafter. And he said, let's see, I'll kind of summarize the email here. He was talking about he was at Super Bowl party, and he says, it occurred to me that you could use any system that had regular bounds but random or pseudo-random results to determine an outcome to a conflict. What if you used something completely outside the game, like a live game of football, to determine in-game results? For example, in a generic dungeon crawl, what if you used first downs, defensive holds, interceptions, and field goals to determine hits, damage, and critical hits? Yeah. I don't see why you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be interesting. You know, there are video games that generate generate levels automatically from music tracks, for example. You know, any kind of you would call that a seed, right?
Right.
Any kind of a piece of seed information that could generate results, that can come from just about anywhere. And if you're a real football nut, why not? I don't see why not.
Yeah, I don't see why not either.
Yeah, but you could do that for a NASCAR race. You could do that for the Olympics, gold medals and countries and whatever. Any kind of an event like that easily could be used to seed something. Now, to make it really playable might be tough, especially if it's a sporting event where things can happen real fast. It would be tough to do that in a live scenario, I think. But if you're just using it as a statistical thing after the fact to drive results,
right?
I don't see why not.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
I've got an email here. I want to apologize. I'm pretty sure we have not read this one on the show before. So I'm going to read it. It's from David Wilkinson. He said, hey guys, I've been listening to the show for many months and really enjoying your show. I'm working on my own game designs and I enjoy listening to the journeys you're both taking. Thank you. Just wanted to say a quick thanks. And also, to tell you two recent game ideas of yours I really liked. One was Beavers Be Damned.
Yeah.
You guys made up an awesome sounding game on the spot. We try. And a 4X game with that theme I can get behind. I've got three young boys, 10 and under, and the lightness of the theme coupled with the fun of building dams, exploring marshland would really be nicely done as long as you kept it fairly simple. I agree with that. I think that's a game, as a 4X game, would need to be a simple one. Yeah. Maybe even just a card game with no board, like to keep it really simple, you know? Also, he really liked our legacy game idea for the generational spaceship. We actually heard some other comments about that, so thank you for that. And good luck with your designs, and I really appreciate you guys, you know, you listening. It's always awesome to hear about that.
Yeah. You know, Jason and I have talked more about Beavers Be Damned for the weeks, many weeks now since we brainstormed that idea. And Jason is super pumped about that idea. And I'm a little more skeptical that theme has legs, has the popularity that I think it might have. So here's what I'd like to propose. Okay. Because Ben Pinchback encouraged us to co-design.
He did.
Yeah.
And so, Ben Pinchback is a super smart guy if you don't know him.
Yeah.
True story.
So here's what I like. As a challenge to our listeners, if you guys want Jason and I to co-design Beavers Be Damned, I want 20 emails or 20 tweets or some combination thereof. Right. Asking us to make Beavers Be Damned. If we can get 20 pieces of feedback starting after the posting.
We should count.
We'll count Davids. All right. So 19 more. Okay. Pieces of feedback, email or Twitter, telling us to make Beavers Be Damned. Then we will move forward co-designing Beavers Be Damned. We will at least take it to the prototype stage. And let's say we'll get a print and play on the website. How about that?
I concur.
At the very least.
I have another email here from David Pyra, who said, I read this on another show. Have you guys thought more about Beavers Be Damned? Because I want to play that game.
All right.
That's 18, two.
18 more. All right. 18 more.
And I have some other verbal ones from people. But we won't count those. But you know who you are, and maybe you should send an email.
We got an email also from our buddy Gray up in Grand Rapids, and I had mentioned before that I thought Chris up in Grand Rapids had bought my copy of Rumplebum, but no, it turns out Gray's the one who bought that copy of Rumplebum. So thank you very much for that, Gray. He sent us some funny pictures of him with his new copy that are marginally creepy pictures, but we won't judge. They're
he very much likes the game, so I think you need to get those up as action shots, man, on the GameCrafter site.
I need to, yeah. But he actually said, here's some action shots of me with the box. Feel free to use them as promotional material.
Seriously.
I certainly will.
They're the best promotional material because he's very excited about the game.
Yeah. And he asked the question, am I the gray thanked at the end of the manual, or have you been seeing other grays behind my back? Yes, you are the gray thanked at the end of the manual because you've been a long-time listener and a long-time supporter of the show, and we really appreciate that. And I wanted to make sure that I thanked you and thanks some of the other people who've really championed where we've gone so far with the show. And I've been with us for a long time. So thank you very much for that, Greg.
Yes.
And thank you for picking up a copy. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can play that together sometime. And I think that's all we got.
Well, we have a... Yeah. But I wanted to give a shout out real quick too. To Andy Lennox. I was going to mention him during the pitch, and then I forgot to. Because him and I were chatting back and forth today, and I was telling him about my pitch for Tailoring Tales, and he gave me some ideas and stuff. Uh-huh. So yeah, that's just want to throw that out there.
Right.
So say a thank you for that.
You and Andy are best buds now.
We are. We talk sometimes. It was funny because he actually said, all of a sudden he types back, I just realized I'm getting spoilers for a future episode of Building the Game. And I said, yes, you are.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
Well,
and then I told him what day this episode would publish to make it even more official as a spoiler.
All right. Don't forget, everybody, about our contest, our holiday game design challenge, courtesy of Scott King. We want you to design a game. Send us a game pitch for a game based on a lesser known holiday. Send us the name of the game, the game pitch, the core mechanics, and the win condition. We send that to buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. Get your entries in by the end of March. The winner will get a free photo session, courtesy of Scott, of their prototype game, their final game, or any other kind of game they want.
And he takes awesome photos.
He does. And he even named a second place prize. Second place will get a bucket of 1,000 cubes in 10 colors. Same set that me and Jason bought several months ago and have just been...
Highly recommended.
Loving. It's so good to have. So... first and second place prizes. The deadline is the end of March. We're really excited about that. I think in either next week or the week after, Jason and I are each going to pitch our own holiday themed game to get you guys excited and in the mood for that contest.
Yes.
And that's what we have for tonight. So thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you and good night.
What do you mean? There's more to say. That's your problem. You just want to get out of here, huh?
No, I just wanted to say thank you and good night.
Well, we're not there yet.
Sorry. Now do your big speech.
If you have any questions, you can send us an email to buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. Jason, you can also follow us on Twitter @podcastbtg.
Oh, there's so many things you have to say. I can't remember them.
You messed up my flow.
Whatever.
Jason is @JASlingerland. I'm @poorly_design. You can like us on Facebook, and you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you want your own copy of the Rumplebum Academy for Bug-Based Baking, you can get that from the Game Crafter. And you can come on back next week and listen to us as we often do, is talk about stuff. I'm a mess tonight.
You're terrible.
Yeah. Good night.
Good night. For real.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
Feature of the week's thing, hydrated while game designing. Make sure to drink at least 12 ounces of water for every 2 hours of game design you do. Game designing can cause a lot of perspiration.
Do you get sweaty when you design games? Because if you do, I think maybe you have bigger issues.
No. Sometimes when designing games, I get really confused. Well, that part's true, but